When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, reader. I'm Cindy Burnett. Welcome to my award-winning podcast, Thoughts from a Page, which is a member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network. On the show, I chat with authors whose books I have enjoyed about their new releases, and I give you a peek behind the curtain of the publishing industry with my Behind the Scenes series. With so many books coming out weekly, it can be hard to decide what to read, so I find the best ones and share them with you. If you're looking for a community of readers, bonus content, and a chance to read books before they hit the shelves, I hope you'll consider joining my Patreon group, which is filled with a wonderful bunch of book lovers. The link to join is in the show notes. Today, I am joined by Tommy Tomlinson to discuss his new book, Dogland. I own two golden retrievers that I absolutely adore and am a big dog lover. The second I saw this book, I knew I needed to read it. I knew very little about the Westminster Dog Show, or really dog shows in general, but I loved learning all about them and the other details that he weaves into his book. Tommy is the author of The Elephant in the Room, a memoir about being overweight in America. He's the host of the podcast Southbound and has written for publications such as Esquire, Sports Illustrated, Forbes, and more. He spent 23 years as a reporter and local columnist for the Charlotte Observer, where he was a finalist for the 2005 Pulitzer Prize in commentary. He lives with his wife in Charlotte, North Carolina. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo, and for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book, and together we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our ninth season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome, Tommy. How are you today?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm really excited to chat with you because I'm a huge dog lover. We have two golden retrievers, and I loved your book, so I have so many questions.
Well, goldens are my favorite, so you're starting out in a good spot there.
Absolutely. We used to have one golden and a terrier mix that was a rescue dog, and we loved her. She was wonderful, and when she passed away, our golden was so sad and lonely, so we picked up a second golden, so they have each other, which really seems to help. It was interesting when you're focusing on our dogs happy and dogs as pets, and I really think it makes a difference sometime for them to have a pet with them. You know, like I feel like she's so much more content with another dog.
Well, they probably understand each other better than humans understand them, right? They could talk to their other dog about things they can't talk to you about.
Exactly. And they also wrestle all over the place all the time. So, I mean, I can't get down on the floor and wrestle quite like Annie does with Stella. So I think they appreciate all of that about each other.
Oh, that's perfect. That sounds like an ideal setting.
Exactly. Well, let's dive into Dogland. Will you first give me a quick synopsis for those that haven't read it yet?
Sure. So this book is kind of technically about the Westminster Dog Show, about its history, where it came from, and it's the narrative, sort of the narrative thread through the book is the story of a very good and very famous show dog named Striker and his handler, a woman named Laura King, as they go through the dog show circuit and then up to Westminster and try to win that dog show. So part of this book is about that. But really the book has got a little bit bigger scope. It's sort of about how dogs and humans have formed this bond over up to 30,000 years, depending on which scientist you talk to, 30,000, certainly tens of thousands of years of connection between dogs and people, how that started, how that formed, and how that's changed both of us.
How did you decide to write this book? And then how did you settle on Stryker?
So I decided to write the book because I was watching a dog show one night, and you know how you just have thoughts that pop into your head every once in a while? I had this thought, I wonder if those dogs are happy because they live such a different life than a regular dog. You know, they're, instead of running out in the yard all day, they're carted around from town to town in RVs and crates. And instead of sort of having unstructured play, they're pranced around a show ring all the time. So I just wondered if those dogs had any sense of what their lives could be like otherwise and whether they were enjoying the lives they had. And as I kept thinking about it, sort of the next level of that question is, well, you know, are regular dogs happy? Because they're certainly in an artificial situation compared to what, say, wild dogs are. You know, they are in a home. They're often, you know, not around other dogs, other animals. They're dependent on humans for everything. Is that a good life for them? And so that led me to go back and look at not just dog shows in general, but sort of that human-dog connection, how that happened and what it means for both sides. And I thought the results and kind of all the way around were really deep and rich and fascinating. And that made it, for me, worthwhile to write a book. Now, Stryker in particular, as I was going through the covering the dog circuit, this is like 2020, 2021, 2022, he was one of the top dogs in the country. And I probably scouted maybe 10 different dogs and their handlers to sort of focus on in the book. And after a while, I started leaning towards him because he was winning all the time, for one thing. And then his handler, Laura King, was somebody who had a really good perspective on dogs and dog shows. She loves that world. She loves dogs. She loves being part of it. But she can also take a step back and see some of the kind of silliness that's involved in dog shows. She has a really good perspective on it. So between those two, that connection, I thought that's a really good a vehicle to take readers on this journey.
And she was obviously receptive to being interviewed by you and being portrayed in the book. Did you find that most of the people at the dog shows were also that way? Were they intrigued that you were writing about it all?
Not everybody. I mean, I think some people, I didn't meet anybody who just wouldn't talk to me. What I did meet were people who were really guarded. I think this is a world where not a lot of outsiders approach. And so I think people were sort of like, what are you doing? Why are you asking me these questions? Because normally the only people who interview these folks are people who work for the trade magazines who are really knowledgeable about this, you know, business and sort of are not likely to write like more hard-hitting type stuff. And so me just wondering from the outside, I think they were probably naturally wary of me. And as I sort of narrowed down the people that I wanted to follow, one of the sort of sorting mechanisms was who was willing to have an open conversation with me about this stuff. And in the end, Laura was just more open and honest and understood what I was trying to do better than anybody.
She checked all the boxes.
She did. And so did her dog.
Exactly. And yes, I'm sure some people worried you were writing an exposé just because there's so much of that these days in any field. And so I wondered how people were when you approached them about it. And they're like, oh, he's here again. What's happening?
Yeah, I think part of what happens there is that the few times that outsiders have come into the dog show, it's often been to sort of mock the whole procedure. You know, obviously there was that movie Best in Show, which I think sort of lovingly mocked the whole dog show world. But that's, you know, 25 years ago, and people in that world still feel a little sting from that movie sometimes. But then there have also been moments like Conan O'Brien sent this guy Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, which was just sort of a guy in a puppet who sort of made fun of, in sort of a crude way a couple of times, the whole concept of the Westminster Dog Show, and in fact got kicked out twice of the dog show. And so I think sometimes that people have come in, it's been with the purpose of making fun of the whole world. That was not my purpose. I certainly wanted to have fun with it. And I wanted to point out the places where it's just sort of weird and silly, like any other subculture. But my idea was to be more of a translator. So people who don't know about this world, I can come in, learn what I can about it, and then translate to a bigger audience sort of what it's all about.
Exactly. And I thought you did that in a very special way, in a good way. You know, you treated them fairly. You explained what was happening. I have to be honest, I've never seen Best in Show. I've never watched a dog show. I just love dogs. So as soon as I saw your book, I was like, well, I need to read it. But now I feel like I need to watch the dog show and I need to go back and pick up Best in Show, because it was really entertaining to learn so much of what you put into your book.
Best in Show is really good. I mean, they actually recruited some real dog judges. There are actual show dogs in that movie. Of course, it's played for laughs and there are some absurd things in there, but sort of the feel of what a dog show is like, they actually got it pretty close. And so I think some people in the dog show world see that sort of fondly. Others, you know, take it a little too seriously, I think. But it's, you know, it's like any other subculture. Anything, if you're on the inside, the stuff that seems strange and weird to people from the outside is normal to you. And so part of what I really love in my work in general is going into these little subcultures that have their own language, their own ways of doing things, their own rules, and sort of going in and figuring that out for myself and trying to figure out the places where they make sense and the places where maybe they don't.
And I always say this about any subculture, that it's just fascinating when you start getting involved in it, learning about it. It's a whole new world. And as you just mentioned, it has its own language, its own quirks, things that from the outside might look a little different. But when you're in the middle of it and it's something you're super involved in, seems totally normal. But I feel like that's the case with so many subcultures.
It is with, and everybody's got something, right? Whatever you do, whether people like to knit or they like to watch soccer or they, you know, fish or whatever it is, every one of those things that people consider their passion, their hobby, whatever it is, they all have that same, their own set of rules, their own set of words, their own ways of doing things, some of which make no sense to people looking in from the outside. And so one of the things I like to play around with in my work is this idea that everybody's got something and that these things have things in common. Even if your thing is not their thing, you can kind of understand where they're coming from.
Exactly. I completely agree. And the more I do this job, reading books, sometimes learning about some of these subcultures, I realize how much they do share. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I think once you figure out the methods are similar and the approach is similar, then I think it kind of opens the door to understand the rest of it for people. Like once I, you know, understood how dog shows work and how that world works, it made me understand sort of the arcane ideas. Like college football is a big thing with me. And when I sit down and watch a game with my wife, for example, who doesn't really care about college football, she's always asking me about the rules. And as I explain the rules, she'll be like, well, that doesn't make any sense. And as I think about it, I'm going, well, it kind of does and it kind of doesn't, to be honest. And so, you know, something like dog shows is very similar. When you get into it, some things, if you're experienced at it, you just get used to and it's what you've always done and it's the way it's always worked. And if you kind of step back a little bit, you're like, well, that's a little crazy that we do it that way. For example, in dog shows, you know, they crop the tails of the dogs and they crop the ears of the dogs for many, many breeds. Things which used to make sense when these dogs were more out in the field hunting dogs that get their tails caught in brambles and that sort of thing. And now it's something that really doesn't make any sense because these dogs are born to be show dogs. They're never going to go out in the field, but they still do it because that's the way it's always been done. And that's something that actually, you know, is a little more serious, but it's just something that from the outside makes no sense. But if you're in the middle of it, it makes perfect sense.
Because you understand where it came from.
Because you understand the reason it was done in the first place and you're continuing that tradition. Now, whether that tradition is a worthy tradition or not is another debate, but they're continuing that tradition. And so to them, it makes sense.
Right. And something a little lighter in that vein is the very long names that dogs are given. You had a couple, you included a bunch, but one of my favorites was Ides of March runs with scissors. And I was cracking up. I was like, okay, so talk a little bit about that, how they have show dog names and then obviously regular names.
Yeah, they have show names and then what they call call names, which is just the regular thing you would call a dog, like Fido or whatever. But the show names are much fancier. And they are, in fact, they had to be, the American Kennel Club at one point decided it was getting out of hand. And I think the limit is like 50 characters now. The general way that's done is the show dog's first name is the name of the kennel it came from. And so in Stryker's case, for example, he came from two different breeders. One was Vanderbilt and one was Printemps. And so it's Vanderbilt and Printemps. And then the other part of the name is something the breeder comes up with that just sort of fits. And this one breeder, Judy Elford, who was Stryker's main breeder, decided that she had had a list of names in her pocket for a while, and she really liked the idea of Lucky Strike. And so his Stryker's full name is Vanderbilt and Printemps Lucky Strike, but they shorten it to Stryker, and that's what everybody calls him. But sometimes these names get, as you said, really elaborate and make absolutely no sense to anybody who's just looking at them like in a catalog or something. But sometimes they're like little in jokes, or, you know, if the dog breeder's a wine lover, it could be something about wine, or it could be some little, you know, nursery rhyme or something. It could be just about anything. And they're all like silly and hilarious.
That was one of my favorite parts of the book, actually, was all of the different details that you included, like the dog names, the history of how they're named and how their names are put together. And just all of it was fascinating. The other thing I really liked were the interludes that you included that you called pee breaks, which I love that name, by the way. That was really clever. And my favorite was the one about famous Westminster dog owners, Lou Gehrig and Barry Bonds, being tied for second. I'm not sure I would have ever expected either one of their names to be listed as Westminster dog owners.
Right. They both owned dogs that were entered in Westminster, obviously many years apart, but these two of the greatest baseball players of all time, both entered show dogs at Westminster. And those pee breaks, the little interludes, were sort of invented out of necessity. As I was doing research on this book, I ran across so many fascinating dogs, dog people, dog stories, that I pretty quickly got overwhelmed at trying to figure out how to weave all of them into the narrative of the book. And at some point, I sort of stepped back and thought, well, maybe I could just like separate the chapters by telling these little mini stories about, for example, famous cartoon dogs or famous dogs in art, or as you said, famous Westminster dog owners. And so throughout the book, in between chapters, I've got these little kind of mini stories about these famous dogs or well-known dogs for one reason or another. It enabled me to get in all these other little stories I loved without having to like wreck the narrative of the book or spend a whole lot of time and space on them.
Well, I was curious about how you decided to format the book and how you decided to structure it. And I figured that's what happened with the pee breaks, was you had so much information that would be fun to share, but it would not fit necessarily in your chapters. But even just trying to structure the narrative, did that take a while?
It did. And that, I'm not a natural at that. And so probably the hardest part of the book for me was figuring out how to make that flow, because I've got several things going on at one time. I've got the story of Laura and Stryker as they go through Westminster and try to win. I've got the story of humans and dogs, this whole vast history that goes back thousands and thousands of years. And I'm trying to tell that story too and make it sort of match up in ways to the story of Laura and Stryker, so that as their relationship develops through the book, you see it kind of in this bigger prism. And then I've also got these little breaks that we talked about, where I'm trying to stop the narrative for a minute and tell you just kind of funny stories or interesting stories about all these kind of famous dogs. And then there's this fourth part that we haven't mentioned yet, where I take a whole chapter and kind of tell the story of this one dog that my wife and I had for 14 and a half great years, and sort of maybe tell his story as a way to maybe in some way sort of summarize the whole of the book in just one little piece.
Well, and personalize it and explain your attachment to dogs.
Sure, yes. that too, and to sort of say, you know, I've got some skin in this game as well. Here's one reason this stuff matters to me is that we had a dog that we loved and cared for very much and learned a lot from as we taught him some things. He taught us some things. So I thought that was important to get that little piece into the book as well.
And to me, that is the beauty of dogs, is that not only do they learn from us, but we learn so much from them and benefit as well.
Yeah, I mean, one way you can look at human history once dogs came along is that as we domesticated them, they also domesticated us. You know, they made us, they enabled us to stop being nomads and build homesteads. They enabled us to move out of factories into homes because they were good guard dogs, you know, and then they've enabled us to live different lifestyles than we were used to even 50 or 100 years ago because they've become such good companions. You know, their lives have evolved greatly over this time that they started out as wolves and now have become hundreds of breeds of dogs, not even to mention all the different mixed breeds and mutts out there. And they have all, in some way or another, learned to adapt to human needs. And along the way, we've learned to adapt to their needs. And in many ways, we've domesticated each other.
I love that. That's a great way to look at it.
Thank you.
And there are so many breeds. That was the other thing that I was totally intrigued by with your book, because every time I turned around, you were introducing another breed, and then you nicely put the footnotes so you could explain a little bit more about the breeds. But there are so many.
Yeah, that the footnotes came from, I knew during the book I would mention a bunch of breeds that I figured most people were not familiar with. And so when I came across one of those, I just made a little footnote that explained kind of what the dog's like, what it's known for, that sort of thing. So there are probably 15 or 20 of those throughout the book as well. And yeah, the breeds are, you know, all, every dog that exists on this planet is related to the gray wolf. That was the original thing that got domesticated into a dog. Those first dogs were bred and rebred in different ways to create all the dogs that we have now. So from the biggest St. Bernard to the tiniest Chihuahua, they all share a common ancestor. And so it's kind of amazing if you think about it, how those genetics were tweaked in so many different ways over so many thousands of years to create all these different dogs. You know, there's probably more varieties of dog than any other animal that we come into close contact with. There's certainly way more different types of dogs than there are of cats, for example, or other animals that we think of as pets. And so they were all created originally to do different jobs. You know, whether it was like pulling sleds or catching, you know, game birds or guarding castles. And now, as I said, they've mostly evolved to becoming our friends and companions and soulmates in a way. And they have figured that out along the way too.
It's mind-boggling to think all of those breeds descend from the same thing, the gray wolf.
Yeah, it just shows the miraculous way that genetics can be tweaked to create so many different things. Now, there's a downside to that too. And I talk about in the book how dogs like the French Bulldog, for example, which is the kind of the most popular dog in America now, the way it's been genetically altered is really bad for its health. Those sort of flat-faced dogs that you think about have lots of respiratory problems. And that's not a good thing for those dogs' lives in the long term. In the short term, we do it because we like to see flat-faced dogs because they look more like us. But we also have to think about what our desires and our needs for a dog, what that means for the dog too. And in some countries, they won't even allow French Bulldogs to be bred anymore. And I think that's the kind of thing that we may have to look at in the U.S. and other places too, to figure out how we take this power that we have to genetically alter dogs and use it so that it's for the dog's good as well.
Definitely. And after I learned about some of that in your book, then I've seen it in the news lately. And then I know a woman who had a French Bulldog and it was stolen out of her yard because they're worth so much because people are breeding them and they've become so popular. So it's always one of those things that I feel like when I learn about something new and I'm like, oh, I've never seen that anywhere, all of a sudden it's everywhere.
Right. Frenchies are You know, there's a whole market. I tell a story in the book about Lady Gaga's French bulldogs got dog-napped, basically.
Right.
Her walker was taking them out one day. These guys pulled up in a car, pulled a gun, and actually shot the dog walker because these dogs, and they didn't even know they were Lady Gaga's dogs. It's just that French bulldogs, for many reasons, are extremely valuable now, and you can get thousands of dollars for one. And so there's sort of a black market in French bulldogs.
Which is crazy. And I remember when that happened with Lady Gaga's dogs, and they originally thought it was because they were her dogs, and then they realized, no, it was just the dogs themselves. So you just think, how wacky is this? I mean, truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah, and that's the case a lot in the dog world.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think in lots of worlds, actually. But what surprised you the most when writing this one?
Oh, boy. I was amazed at how well-behaved the show dogs were. You know, at the beginning of the book, one of the things I talk about is that I wander into this dog show where there's like 2,000 dogs around. And if you had to pay pretty close attention if you closed your eyes to even know there were any dogs there because they were so quiet. You would think a normal, like at a dog park or anything where there would be that many dogs around, it would just be a cacophony, right? But these dogs are so well trained that even if there's, you know, chaos sort of right around them, they just take it in such stride. They are so beautifully tethered to their own reality in a way that most pets are not. And that just comes from, first of all, generation after generation of breeding to create these show dogs, and then years and years of training to help them be able to be unruffled in the big moments, which is what you want a show dog to be. When the lights are on, everybody's watching, people are paying attention, you want them to be as natural as possible. And there's a couple of moments in the book when that doesn't happen, and it's really startling because these show dogs are so precisely trained to be well-behaved.
You just said exactly what I was going to say, that not only do you start the book with that, but that thread is woven throughout your story. And there are times when they don't behave like that, and then everybody is totally stunned or surprised, or it impacts their performance in the show.
Yeah, and what they are in that moment is kind of reverting back just to being a regular dog, which is something that, you know, in the dog show world, being a regular dog is not an attribute. And so in those moments when they sort of revert to their raising, I guess, revert to their inheritance, it is sort of startling.
But you understand it, because I can't even imagine either one of my dogs being able to do that. First, be quiet for very long, and two, be able to sit there and not just pay attention to everything around them.
It is sort of an astounding level of training and handling. It shows, first of all, the quality of the dog, and then the really real skill of a professional handler.
True. Well, I always love to talk about titles and covers. I love your cover. So tell me a little bit about it. I know why it's purple and everything, but I'd love for you to tell my listeners.
Sure. So the color scheme is purple because the official color of the Westminster Dog Show is purple. Purple and gold are sort of their main colors. And so we wanted something that sort of matched that. And the cover itself, the striker, the dog I write about, is not the dog on the cover. We went through the art department at Simon & Schuster that's published this book, went through a bunch of interesting pictures of dogs and dog handlers, dog show photos, that sort of thing, and chose this photo. The dog on the photo is an Afghan hound, which because of the way its hair is combed and all, looks almost human. And so you get this picture of the Afghan hound and a handler. The handler is cropped in a way where you don't see her face. You just see her kind of body in the leash, and you see the hound. And so it's sort of mysterious, I think, in a way, and sort of striking. And so I really love that image on the cover and the way the whole thing was put together.
I agree. I think it's perfect. And Dogland comes because you call Dogland, Dogland, you call the show and just the whole subculture Dogland. But tell me a little bit about the subtitle.
The subtitle is Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. And I wanted to make sure that I got across the idea that there was interesting stuff, really emotional stuff, but also kind of the goofiness of dogs. Dogs, you know, no matter how well-groomed a dog is, you cannot keep a big dog from slobbering. One of the things they teach you when you go to dog shows is how to pet a show dog. You don't pet the top of its head because it's been brushed and groomed and maybe even powdered a little bit and sprayed. So you don't want to mess that up. And so if you're allowed to pet a show dog, you kind of reach under its chin and kind of give it a little scratch. And often when you do that, you come away with a handful of drool. And so I wanted to make sure that was part of the subtitle as well.
Okay, I love that. Well, before we wrap up, what have you read recently that you really liked?
Well, in the dog world, I can recommend without reservation the works of a woman named Alexandra Horowitz. She's a dog cognition expert, and she's written several books. Inside of a Dog, Being a Dog are two of them. If you really want to understand the best current thinking on how we think dogs think and what that means for them and what that means for us, her books are unparalleled. I think she's the best.
And she's the one that's at Barnard College, is that right?
That's right. She's at Barnard College, yeah.
My daughter's there. And so when I saw that, I thought, oh, how funny. I'm going to have to get Emily to go by and meet her because we love dogs. And I thought, that's so funny that she's at Barnard.
Yeah, she's great. For other stuff, you know, I'm just now that the book's been edited, is getting ready to come out in a couple of weeks, I am just now sort of getting back into like reading for pleasure again. And a friend of mine gave me the set of books by Richard Russo. And he's probably most well known for a book that I just finished called Nobody's Fool. Nobody's Fool is a big sprawling story about these people in a small town in upstate New York back in the 80s. It was made into a really good movie with Paul Newman back probably in the 90s. And so I just finished Nobody's Fool and was just totally caught up in this world of small town, sort of losers and nobodies and hustlers. And it was just excellent. And it felt so good to read a book that wasn't about dogs for a change, even though there's a dog in it who plays a key role. But that book was something I could recommend without reservation.
I love his book, Empire Falls.
Yeah, that's next on my list.
Okay, good. Yes, he's a wonderful writer. Well, Tommy, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today on the Thoughts from a Page podcast. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Don't you know that you're a grown-up?
I'm a grown-up.
Me too.
Yep, me too. But you know, these days, being a grown-up can really suck.
Luckily, we're grown-ups who grew up in the coolest generation.
We had video arcades.
And also some of the best TV and movies ever made.
We lived the origin of awesome consumer electronics. The list goes on and on.
Yep, Generation X.
Exactly.
And we're Gen X Grown-Up.
Every week, the Gen X Grown-Up podcast explores media, tech, toys, games, and more from both yesterday and today.
Through the eyes of Generation Xers who absolutely love that stuff. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or find us on our website, genxgrownup.com. Life sucks as a grown-up.
All right. You think that was good enough?
I hope so, man. I'm tired.
Who listens to a promo on a podcast and then goes and listens to a different podcast?
Right. I've never done it. Right.
Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. I would love to connect with you on Instagram or Facebook, where you can find me at Thoughts From A Page. If you enjoy the show, please consider joining my Patreon group to access bonus content and support the podcast. If you have a moment to rate the show or subscribe to it wherever you listen to your podcasts, I would really appreciate it. It makes a big difference. And please tell all of your friends about Thoughts From A Page. Word of mouth does wonders to help the show grow. The book discussed in this episode can be purchased at my bookshop storefront, and the link is in the show notes. I hope you'll tune in next time.
You know, a lot can happen in 7 minutes, and luckily, that's how long it takes me to tell a story. My name is Aaron Calafato, and I'm the creator of 7-Minute Stories. I'm proud to partner with Evergreen Podcasts, and I'd like to invite you to join me on this journey. I'm going to take you on some crazy roller coaster rides using my unique extemporaneous storytelling style, and together, we're going to try to make sense of the world, all through the art of storytelling, and all in approximately 7 minutes.
Science, science, science! Science, science! Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes, yes! Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.